Okay, this is Talking with Graham Smith on 27th August 76 at Grenoble. So, can you tell me just what your background was before you joined the radio astronomy group at Cambridge?
I was very much of a physicist and a radio physicist at that. Of course, like some of the other radio astronomers, I came from wartime radar research, telecommunications research establishment in Malvern. And I had no particular interests in astronomy. I can't say that I was an astronomer as a small boy or anything like that.
Right.
I was definitely a physicist, a scientist, without any particular leanings, except that I was interested in radio, and I obviously felt myself to be more of a practical type than a theorist. So that it was mainly to get back to Cambridge and finish my degree, but also with an interest in radio, that took me back to Cambridge after the war, and that of course took me on into radio astronomy as a research project.
So it could have just as well been radio work with anything, the ionosphere
or laboratory work. And of course when I joined the group, radio astronomy didn't exist, certainly not by name, and it was only solar work, with of course some ionospheric work going on. Ionospheric work was the dominant thing in the radio group at the time.
Right. Well, how was it decided that you would work with Ryle?
Well, I knew him, of course, during the war, and I think I picked up and soon shared his enthusiasms for the radio waves from the sun, which mm-hmm. was the thing that was going at that time.
Right, but now, what was the first thing you worked on? I don't think it was solar, was it? Or am I forgetting?
I worked with Martin Ryle on solar work even before I became a research student, because it so happened that we lived in the same house. His house in Herschel Road, which he now lives in, was at that time divided into three flats, and one of the flats was shared between my wife and myself and Derek Vonberg and his wife. So that we were all closely associated. The third flat was occupied by a zoologist who had also been a friend during the war. And when Martin Ryle was, Ryle and Vonberg were working on interferometric measurements of the sun. This was just outside the back gate, and so we used to help them move around the antennae, particularly at the time, I remember the July 46 sunspot thing, when it was first shown that the radiation actually came from the sunspot rather than the whole disk. We were helping move the antennae around, broadside arrays, to larger and larger spacings to make an interferometric measurement of the diameter.
I see.
I think it was this that really caught my imagination.
So although you never were a co-author in this work, you were quite involved with it.
Well, really only as a pair of hands.
Oh.
But this is what I think sparked my interest.
And also, just for the record, I have learned somewhere that there's a relationship by marriage between you and Ryle.
That's correct, yes. I think it's fair to say that my wife introduced her sister to Martin Ryle.
I see. So you helped with the solar work, but what were you mainly working on in these first couple of years? Was that really it?
I think it was about the time I started when Hay had published the point source in Cygnus, and Bolton, of course, was also working on point sources and was publishing from the Southern Hemisphere. I think it was Hay's work on Cygnus that really started us, and I then worked with Martin Ryle, modifying apparatus which was originally interferometric work on the Sun,
right,
so as to work on radio stars, as they were then called.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it was 81 megahertz, an interferometer which consisted of four Yagis at each end of the baseline. It was with this that we first detected the Cygnus source. And of course, at the same time, to our astonishment, Cassiopeia A came up on the same recording a few hours later.
Yeah.
From then on, we were into the radio star business, as it was called then.
Right. Is it true that, I asked Martin Ryle this, and I think he said it was, that in your first paper, Ryle and Smith in 48, you talk about another source, which is variable in intensity, the cast coming through the backlobe, is it?
That's right. That's right, yes. That stayed in the catalogs for some years.
What about these variations? What did you think they were when you first heard about them?
The variations in the supposed source, in the one that wasn't real.
No, in Cygnus.
The ones in Cygnus.
Yes.
Oh, I think we. That's hard to say precisely, but I think we were perfectly prepared to think of ionospheric effects. And we spent a lot of time trying to distinguish between ionospheric effects and intrinsic effects by using spaced receivers and that sort of thing.
Right.
That developed quite rapidly.
In fact, I've just come across the two papers, Little and Lovell and yours,
yes,
published together. Could you tell me about that? That's one of the few Cambridge-Jodrell collaborations over the years.
That's right, yes. In fact, I mean, the observations were made more or less independently, but it was obvious we were after the same thing, and it was obvious that the two papers should be published together. You see that, in fact, those were separate papers published at the same
time,
right?
That's right. Right. But didn't you go up to Jodrell and...
Oh, yes. We went up there and talked to them, and we made sure that the papers came out together because we were obviously onto the same thing.
Yeah.
Furthermore, we actually did compare some of the recordings made simultaneously at the two places so as to see whether there was anything which was obviously intrinsic to the source.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I think, really just at that time that we showed that at least those fluctuations came from the ionosphere.
I see. So it sounds like from what you're saying, it's difficult for me to determine from the published record that you all along suspected the ionosphere. It's just a matter of pinning it down, that you never really thought that it was intrinsic.
I think we were open-minded, but at the same time, the radio group had a very strong ionospheric background,
right,
because Radcliffe was responsible for so much of it. And so it's natural that we should turn to the ionosphere as the explanation of this.
Right.
And in the same way, when position finding started up, then it was natural to look for ionospheric refraction, you see. And in fact, I did quite a bit on that. As you know, it led me to a measurement of the total electron content of the ionosphere, which was, I think, again, an indication of our ionospheric interest in
right.
the group and the record.
Right. Did you know about the Australian work, which was going on more or less simultaneously with the end of the 6A fluctuations?
Not really, no. I think that at that time, we, not being astronomers, you know,
right,
we weren't really very conscious of what was going on anywhere else in any kind of astronomy. And we weren't really very conscious of what was happening in Australia, even in radio astronomy. I think it's true to say that the radio astronomers in Australia probably found it just the same way.
Yeah, yeah.
And we worked really quite independently, and then found that we were producing answers on the same sorts of problems,
yeah,
which produced interesting situations.
Well, at this stage, or are you referring to later stages in particular?
Well, of course, we very quickly were measuring positions for Cygnus A in particular,
right,
and the Australians were on to the same question, and it really very quickly became competition as to who could get an accurate enough answer
right.
to be meaningful.
But there were no great conflicts on those early positions. That's my recollection.
No, there were no great conflicts, but you know, at times we had a more accurate position than they
right,
had, and
right.
so forth. And that was the element.
Yeah, with the exception of Bolton's, some of Bolton's, he's several
Bolton,
degrees off.
Bolton's was somewhat off at one time.
That got corrected rather quickly. Yeah.
Well, that's right. Yes. Yes.
What about the identifications? While we're talking about this Australian versus the British groups, what about the identifications that came out, tentative ones of Virgo?
And the crab.
Right.
And the crab as well. Yeah.
How did you view those? Did you?
I think it's fair to say that we were pretty blinkered and busy on our own work, and we didn't take an awful lot of notice of what was happening elsewhere. And so it was some time before it dawned on us that their positions were leading to real identifications. After all, they did get at that time the first tentative identification of the supernova remnant, the crab, and they did get Centaurus A, the first extragalactic object. And we maybe looked at these and said, look here, these positions aren't good enough for real identifications. And looking back on it, of course, they were dead right.
Yeah.
And I think we ought perhaps to have shared their enthusiasm for these identifications. And maybe we could have said right away to optical astronomers, if we'd been talking to them, look, this is what's happening, it's
yeah.
so exciting.
Yeah.
But I think at that point our horizons weren't yet expanded.
Well, you think you would have gotten anywhere with the optical astronomers?
Oh, I think there were one or two people in Cambridge who were interested in what was
well,
going on. Yes.
Dewhurst.
Dewhurst in particular, yes. And I think Redman, although he's a man who some people would say was old-fashioned, in fact, would have taken it very seriously, because he really was an encouraging chap to talk to.
But now you did, in the 1C survey paper, try to make identifications with many nearby galaxies.
Yes.
And I don't quite understand your remarks saying you should have been a little more enthusiastic in trying, because you actually went a bit overboard as it was.
We did. No, I mean, what I mean by enthusiasm, I think we should have taken the Australian result more enthusiastically.
Oh, I see what you say. Yeah. I see.
I think at that time we were saying this sort of positional accuracy isn't good enough. Because in point of fact, of course, it was, as it turned out. And I think that was maybe a mistake.
Well, at least for objects that are that unusual.
That's right, that's right, yes. It was perhaps a lucky guess, but it was a very good guess.
But one didn't know how low down you were going to have to go before...
No.
They wouldn't become so unusual.
That's right, and then we felt that we were getting accurate positions out because we've got this... Michelson type interferometer rather than the Lloyd's mirror over the sea.
Right.
And we felt that we were getting more accurate positions out. And then, of course, we didn't appreciate right from the start how many sources there were going to be, and so we didn't appreciate the confusion situation.
Well, you're jumping ahead now.
I know, but even so, when you talk about 1C, 1C was, let me think, how many sources did we think we could see at 50? Well, you see, most of those were wrong, and that was a confusion.
Well, I've never checked that out. I mean, I've looked at sort of the 5 or 10 obvious ones and tried to see what they correspond to now. But I've never actually gone through the whole list. So you're saying that most of them turned out to be...
Most of them spurious. I didn't realize that. I think it was at that stage where we were saying, fortunately not out loud in the publication, that we had definitely got several of the extragalactic nebulae, M31, M33, M81, and so forth. And we could prove with... cross-line statistics that all these identifications were real, because you couldn't have accidental identifications of so many sources.
Right.
In point of fact, I believe those identifications were entirely without foundation because of the confusion, even in the 1C days.
I see. I'll have to look at that again more closely. Now, implicitly, we haven't talked about it explicitly, is that you built an aerial to do a full survey, having got Cygnus and Cass. Apparently decided that the thing to do was to really properly survey the sky.
Yes.
So could you tell me about that?
Well, I think we have to say straight away that this was really Ryle's inspiration, which we were all sort of enthusiastically joining in with. Of course, there were two directions we went. One was to get accurate positions, and that involved the interferometer, which I used a great deal, using the two 27-foot dishes, Boltzmann dishes. And at the same time, we were developing larger arrays to try and see more sources. And I think the development of the arrays was very much a joint effort, although, of course, Martin Ryle was throughout the prime mover. The first idea to get a big array was to build a thing in the form of a bedstead, and there we made a flat reflecting surface using... stretched piano wires on an angle iron frame with a broadside array of dipoles above it, and we made one for each end of the interferometer range we had, and we used that. And then the next stage was really to go to larger reflector arrays. We had all sorts of ideas of trying to make very large area collecting areas cheaply, and we thought of arrays of Yagis and other sort of travelling wave sort of antennas and so forth. But we ended up building the large steerable cylindrical paraboloids. Those are the ones which really got going,
right.
Those large radio telescopes.
I should ask you at this stage, what was your experience in working in the radar in the war? Was it antennas primarily?
It was largely microwaves, as they were in those days, that's coaxial cables. So that I found it fairly easy to get on to low noise amplifiers and coaxial cable techniques, and in particular things like hybrid arrays and diode switches and things. In fact, I had a paper in the IEEE about hybrid arrays.
I see.
That, I would say, was partly sparked off by Bernard Burke, who turned up at the Department of Terrestrial Magnetism in Washington when I was there.
Right. This is now 54, so
this is 53, I think, yeah. yes. But that shows my interest, I think,
right.
in sort of coaxial cables and techniques and things. And antennas came quite easily, yes.
Well, now going back to the 1C survey, what did you think you could do with this data besides the identifications that were attempted?
I think our objectives were just to see what it was could be seen in the sky. I mean, it was of course, astonishing that the sun produced everything. Even more astonishing that there were a lot of point sources in the sky. And the question then came, what sort of things can you do? Well, the first thing is you try and identify. And second, you may decide that you can find something statistically about the sky. And on the first 50 sources, I did in fact do a log n, log s plot.
That's right.
Which I think was the first one.
That's right.
I remember sort of a flash of inspiration that this would be a good idea, and it's so funny to look back and realize that optical astronomers had been having all these thoughts years beforehand, but yet they come as an entirely new idea.
Okay, so it was not based at all on the plots that they've been making of magnitude versus number?
Not at all, yes. No. I didn't have a clue. I had not been in contact with optical astronomers.
How were you learning your astronomy? Just sort of reading a chapter in a book when it became necessary? Or?
Well, you see, I think I was acting much more as a radio engineer, and we were thinking in terms of radio techniques and doing what we could to pick up radio signals from the sky. Now, you find you bump up against astronomy, conventional astronomy, almost by accident. I mean, for example, when you come to finding that, take the time when Cassiopeia first appeared on the record.
Right.
Now, this was a great occasion. I remember turning up at the laboratory, and the thing had been set running, and there was an interferometer trace of Cygnus, just as it should be. It looked absolutely marvelous.
Right.
And then 3 hours later, or whatever it was, another interferometer trace, which subsequently turned out to be Cassiopeia. But nobody had ever been seeing this radiation before. We didn't know it was there. It had appeared as a fluctuating trace with a different periodicity in Cygnus A.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this was a complete surprise, and we thought it must be something to do with the way things moved in the sky, but we had no training, neither of us, in celestial coordinates. And I went away to think about it, and I remember coming into the Cavendish lab an hour or two later and saying to Martin Ryle and to Ratcliffe, I think it's in a constellation called Cassiopeia. And then, of course, came the problem using the Wurzburg dishes, which incidentally were largely constructed by another chap, Machin, who appears in these early papers.
Right.
There came the problem of finding positions with such an interferometer.
Well, hold on now. How did you get in the constellation Cassiopeia? After thinking about it, you determined that indeed the fringe.
I decided that fringe rates would be different,
yeah,
according to the distance from the pole.
Right.
So
okay.
I that was my first introduction to spherical astronomy.
Right. Okay. And when you say that that Machin was the one that built the Wurzburg dishes,
this was largely his. He was also very much engineering inclined, and when it came to the idea that we ought to build an accurate interferometer, where the electrical centers of everything could be accurately determined and so on, for finding accurate positions,
mm-hmm,
of anything, solar sources as well as other things, he largely did the construction, and I took over, and I did, I think, most of the electrical engineering work on it.
Yeah.
I installed coaxial cables and so forth. Well, we all joined in those days. But to give another example of my lack of astronomical background, when it came to using the accurate interferometer, of course I had to take account of the fact that this was a transit instrument which was not aligned on an east-west axis. In fact, it was 5 degrees off. And so
Why was that?
It was built along the hedge of a field.
Oh, I see. Which some farmer set up by according to how the sun was one day or something.
Precisely, yes. Right. It was roughly east-west as far as we were concerned, but it became rather important to note that it wasn't exactly east-west,
right,
it was 5 degrees off, and it was about 20 minutes of arc off level, you see. And it was also an unknown distance apart, which we had to measure rather carefully. We had to find out where there was a standard 100 metres, which was not so easy. We found it in the surveyor's department in the county hall. At any rate, to find out how to correct for this 5 degrees, I had to learn some spherical trigonometry. I was in fact invigilating in the TRICOS examination during that summer, and I spent the hours of peace one gets in an examination room working out spherical trigonometry from scratch.
I see.
And I worked out how to correct for the lack of east-west and the lack of level of the instrument. I'm proud to say I got the right signs for these corrections.
Right.
And it was after I had completed my calculations and found the positions of these sources that I was told that a chap called Bessel had done it a few years earlier.
And Bessel, you're referring to V. Bessel, the mathematician?
V. Bessel, yeah. Bessel, the mathematician.
Right, right.
And if you look in the textbooks on spherical astronomy, of course, it's all set out there. But yeah. I wasn't familiar with these textbooks.
But of course, these things are not a complete loss by any means when
not
one has really gone through
not
it from scratch.
Not at all. I'm very pleased to have done it. And I didn't waste an awful lot of time over it,
yeah.
In fact.
Well, tell me now, I think we're coming to the stage where you must have determined that you really needed to get good positions on the source that you could get them for, namely the few strongest.
Yes.
And so how did you go about doing that?
Yes, I think one's motivations can be very simply set out as saying you do the next thing which you know you can do well. And it was obvious that we could get good positions on this. We knew of the Australian attempts, as we thought of them, to identify, and we thought that these are not good enough, we've got to get better positions. And we had this accurate interferometer going. So that I spent some time, first of all, I worked at the lower radio frequency, 80 megahertz, using the arrays we've already talked about. And there you have to worry about refraction, mm-hmm. ionospheric refraction, which of course turned out to be a subject in itself. But as soon as we'd got the dishes, we went to a higher frequency, which I remember was 214 megahertz, because it, again, corresponded to some old wartime radar equipment. Oh, good heavens, yes, I remember we did, in fact, use an array, a radar array, which was an array of Yagis on a single mount for a time, and then we went over to the Wurzburg dishes.
I see.
So that somewhat determined the frequency we worked on, 214 megahertz. Now, that's not much affected by refraction by the standards of those days. And that was really when I sort of did a concentrated piece of work, which was very much all my own, I think, position-finding work.
Right.
And that led to the positional accuracies of about a minute of arc.
Right.
On four sources.
This is the paper Nature.
That's right, yes.
1950 or 51, one or the other.
That's
50...
it, yes. Oh, I can't remember the exact one. It would be about 51.
51, I think
51.
It was.
Yes. Yes.
Now, having gotten... Well, what else? I think there must have been more troubles than simply worrying about refraction.
I don't remember running into really severe troubles. I remember developing techniques, getting amplifiers with good noise performance and so forth. These were the old wartime radar preamplifiers, disc-sealed triodes. And I spent a little time understanding noise factor of these things and mm-hmm. the sources of noise. In fact, I understand noise sources in triodes better than I understand transistors. I think we just made steady progress doing this. Mm-hmm. There wasn't a real setback in it. It was just sort
but
of...
But the net result was a quantum improvement, factor 10 almost, and one arc minute from
well, it's,
7 or 8 was the best...
Yeah, I think that one sometimes strikes lucky in the jobs which stare one in the face, and this is what happened at that time.
So, given that you had these positions, what does one do with them?
Well, we did at that time know one or two people in the observatory. For one thing, we were interested to know what our latitude was, and I had discussed this problem, particularly with Dewhurst at the observatory.
Uh-huh.
And I'd been along there and talked to him about problems of identification. And he, of course, was the first chap who really tried to identify the Cygnus and right. the Cassiopeia sources.
Well, I talked to him in Cambridge, so yes. he gave me his side of the trying, and he came up with sort of 1.5 identifications.
That's right.
Depending on how one wants to look at it.
That's right. Yes. And at that point, the advice to write to Bader came definitely from the observatory. Whether it was directly from Dewhurst or from Redmond, I really can't remember.
I see.
Yes, it came from there.
And also David Edge, has shown me, or he didn't actually show me, but he told me about the correspondence that's in the final book that you gave him between yourself and Bader, which
yes.
I would very much like to have copies of if you'd be willing.
Yes, certainly. I don't know what's the best way of getting them. Well, I hope I can put my hands on a copy, but otherwise there should be copies in the Cavendish. And David Edge, you said, has got a copy.
Well, I'm not sure he got copies or whether... I think he must have made copies for him.
I suspect so, yeah. yes. I mean, you're probably directly in correspondence with him. Why don't you try and get
okay,
one
so
him?
I have your permission anyway
course,
to do that.
Of course,
okay,
yes,
fine.
Certainly. Yeah.
And it was very soon, I think it was just a couple of months after the Nature article, when Bader got Cygnus
yes.
and Cass, I guess.
But, that's right, yes.
And I guess he wrote to you at that time, and what was
yes.
your reaction then?
Oh, it was very exciting. It really was, I think, the first feeling that we were astronomers. Here were real-life astronomers saying that what we had done was exciting, and that these were... of course, let's be fair, that had happened on the solar work before. A lot of interest in the solar work had brought us in contact with astronomers, but here was a completely new field of astrophysics. It brought us in contact with the Californian astronomers for the first time.
Right.
And that was certainly very exciting. And the thought that we'd got objects in which new physical processes were going on was also very exciting.
But now, this is interesting you say that the optical solar astronomers had shown some interest, because I've just been talking with Christensen, and he said that there was the very rare one that really...
All right, it was the rare one, but we knew that we were in astronomy doing solar work, and we...
I see.
I think the later work on sources, I think we really still felt ourselves as radio engineers finding out what it was that was coming from the sky, and we didn't feel ourselves as part of having any sort of place in the
uh-huh.
in the community.
Uh-huh.
And I think it was from that time on that we really felt as though we were slotting in, and we would get something from them, and they would get something from us.
So what was the next step? Again, you did not really go along the identifications route yourself. I mean, in terms of... No.
It would be definitely our task to carry on the kind of thing that we had done, and obviously had begun to do quite well. So there, you then have to build a larger array and get more sources and get accurate positions from that. So we were all very much involved in techniques and actual efforts of construction. And as you know, we worked very much with our hands. We got very good at wielding sledgehammers and all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, I think that I kept going on positions with the ionospheric work, and I can't remember when would be the last publication of mine on the ionospheric work. It would be about that time, I suppose. And then I think I helped in a lot with the sort of 2C and 3C survey construction
right.
work.
And if I remember right, you're not a co-author on the 2C, actually.
No.
But
no,
you were working with the Ariel and
so forth. We all worked together very much.
Did you get involved with the interpretation of 2C and the definition of what a radio source was and so forth? I mean, before it got published, I mean.
Yes, I think we were still not so many that we were in any way differentiated in what we did.
Mm-hmm. And I can't refrain from asking, as this went along, did you see any problems developing, or did you too many sources? I mean, you've already mentioned it.
Not really. I think it's a problem which came to us by stages. I mean, each time we realized that we needed more angular resolution, well, so you build a larger antenna, and you get more sensitive, and you see more of the darn things,
right.
you see. And it isn't until you really reach the 3C, and after the 3C had been published, that there is a full realization of the magnitude of the problem.
But so the comment you made about one city was definitely one in hindsight. There was no idea at the time at all that a large fraction of those might be in trouble.
I don't think that there was full appreciation of what a large number of very small sources can do. But of course there was an appreciation of the fact that sources were not being seen singly, and that you'd therefore got to get better angular resolution before you could really be sure of what you were doing.
That blending, you mean, was...
Yes, there was obviously obvious blending, but the full horror of the situation, that there were a very, very large number of sources to be detected, and those and much of the blending was a blending of a very large number of small sources, I don't think that was really fully appreciated until the analysis of 3C by Hewish and Scheuer and
Edge.
I mean, I think if there had been a full appreciation, 3C wouldn't have been published as it was.
Or 2C, you mean?
2C. Well, even 3C was had quite a lot in it of that.
Well, okay, I'm not quite aware. I've always thought of 3C as had some fringe lobe, as to which lobe shifts problems, but...
That, well, there's 3C and 3C Revised,
right,
of course. And 3C Revised is a much sounder catalogue than 3C. 3C is certainly affected not just by lobe shifts, but by some over-optimistic interpretations of individual sources, which are not real.
Okay, well, I didn't realize that. 3CR...
3CR is pretty sound.
Right. but what were the differences? First of all, checking for lobe shifts.
Yes. That's right, and using more stringent criteria about identifying individual sources. That was done by Bennett, of course,
right.
But I had quite a bit to do with that.
Can you be more explicit about these criteria?
I think that's a little hard. Bennett was set the task, which I think I supervised quite largely, of referring back to the original records and sorting out which sources were quite unequivocally right, which behaved, produced a proper beam shape in both coordinates, and being as objective as possible when one could say that there was not likely a beam shift and when there was likely a beam shift. I mean, there are many fewer sources in 3CR than there are in 3C. And that was a result of that weeding process.
I see. I must admit, I've looked at 3C, but I haven't looked at 3CR. That came out in 62 or...
Yeah, that's I can't remember something like that. That was Bennett.
Right.
Well, if you compare those two, you'll see there is a difference.
Okay, well now, if you'll bear with me, this will go a little bit slower. I don't know if I had a nice card made up, but... Let's just see if we've missed any points. Okay, we've got the 1C survey, we've talked about the ionospheric stuff, so now moving on to 51. You had the paper in Nature that we mentioned about the four radio stars.
Yeah.
And then you also had one about trying to measure the annual parallax.
That's right.
Or proper motion.
That's right. Well, of course, that's right. This was... a long continuing series of observations. I remember observing those four sources throughout a year with not missing many days or nights.
Mm-hmm.
And of course those four darn sources came across the meridian at fairly evenly spaced times through the day and night. So I got entirely used to getting up, dashing out, taking an observation, coming back to bed. And that was because we hadn't identified them at the beginning of that. So we really didn't know whether they were near or far.
Mm-hmm.
We had no clear idea whether these things were even possibly in the solar system. Certainly we had no idea whether they were in the galaxy or extragalactic. And so we thought, well, they may show parallax, they may show proper motion. Let's just go on measuring the positions. And of course, you find the ionosphere is a nuisance in that, so you find yourself investigating the ionosphere, and in point of fact, we don't measure any parallax or proper motion.
Right.
That's the way it goes.
Right. Can I ask you, can you remember sort of what your inclination was? I just see we're going to get inundated here.
Uh-huh.
Storm from the...
It may not rain.
From the east.
It comes every night, but it didn't actually rain last night.
That's true. No, we'll wait.
Yes.
What was your predilection at that time as to the nature of these things?
The nature of the position shifts.
No, of the sources.
Of sources.
The star, radio stars, as they were.
Well, certainly when I worked out a log N, log S, I was thinking of them as galactic objects. Martin Ryle had some speculations in a paper in Proc. Physsoc, as I remember, as to the nature of things. And I think we were all a bit baffled about the possible radiation mechanism. The idea of synchrotron radiation was coming out in a paper by Alf Bain and Herlofsson about that time.
And Kiepenhauer.
And Kiepenhauer as well, yes. But and we hadn't really sort of latched on to this, so we hadn't got much of a good physical picture as to what they could be.
You bring that up. Of course, the Russians really carried the ball for this synchrotron radiation, but you were aware of the FISREV article that they produced in 1950.
Yes, I think so, but I wouldn't say that anyone, any one of us, saw with a flash that these must be radiating by synchrotron, for instance, and must therefore be at a very, or could therefore be at a very great distance. Yeah. I mean, I think one would need to be very perceptive to pick up one of those short articles and suddenly see if the whole thing has fallen into place.
Well, sure, they were put forth as a speculation.
It's more gradual than that.
Well, here's another one, Machen and Smith, on a new radio method for measuring the electron density in the solar corona.
Oh, yes.
Nature in 51. Could you tell me about that?
Oh, yes. Well, I can't remember who had the first ideas on that. I have an idea it might be Machen, but we certainly discussed together the ideas of refraction in the solar corona. And this obviously ties in with our ionospheric interest.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that if you keep on measuring the position of the radio source and it gets close to the sun, you may be able to see an extended solar corona because of its refraction. And we tried this.
Right, in 1551.
That's right. And of course it didn't work because what you see is irregular diffraction rather than a regular refraction. In fact, regular refraction wasn't seen for quite a long time later.
So this is telling you something about the nature of the corona.
Indeed, yes. Yes.
Yourself. Did you follow that up at all?
I was in it for a year or two, but then that very much became Hewish's work, and it still is.
Right. And I talked to him about that in the recent past. Yes. I think we better move inside.
Yeah.
So an occultation in 52 was also reported in Nature by you and Machen in 52.
That's right, yes. I think that was probably the last one that I was involved in there.
And 14. Okay, here's another set of observations. This was on the angular sizes.
Ah, well, now this is a different subject that I really moved on to at this point. As you know, you get angular diameters by using interferometers of different spacings.
Right.
And we didn't have anything on railway lines at that time. We only had an interferometer with a fixed spacing. So I started the idea of using a smaller portable antenna, which I used in conjunction with the two fixed ones to make two baselines that I could use either sequentially or even at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, I did make the measurements of the diameters of the Cygnus A and Cassiopeia A radio sources.
What was the real motivation to get these angular diameters? Was it to aid in identifications or to learn about the physics of the sources or what?
I think identifications first, but again, I think one has to remember that the sort of the joy of being able to measure anything and say,
right.
By gosh, we can not only measure the positions, we can also measure the diameters.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, as a physicist of a practical experimental turn of mind, one immediately recalls Michelson's work and said, well, gosh, we can do the same sort of thing that Michelson did. It's not long before you're led on to Fourier analysis of source distributions. In fact, of course, in Australia, Pawsey was onto that with the solar work,
right.
And he used, I think he was probably the first person to point out that you could use Fourier methods
of
this sort.
Right, I think so.
And I think that the attitude is the same in both cases. You find a radio physicist who suddenly finds that he can apply his interests and techniques into a new field. And you don't sit around saying, I wonder what these sources are. If I could measure the diameters, I would be able to tell. How can I measure the diameters?
I see.
You work the other way. You find that you've got a jolly good technique. And you say, well, what's the most interesting ways of applying this technique? And from that, you get to the fact that these radio sources have finite diameters. And then you start thinking again, well, maybe this tells me something about them.
Right. Would you say that that happens at all today? Or is it more the other way today?
I think it's more the other way today because we have very much more sophisticated radio telescopes, which are, of course, capable of measuring very many more things than they ever will measure. And in a way, we were working on techniques which had quite a limited application because all the antennas and so forth were pretty small.
Right.
And it's really that we say that if we just modify this bit of apparatus, or build a slightly better bit of apparatus, we can measure something more.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas today, to measure something more, you can go on using the same apparatus on different objects.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So you naturally say, what are the most interesting objects to do this measurement on? And that takes you more in the way of conventional astronomy.
Yeah, yeah. Was the thrust to measure angular sizes influenced by the concept of radio stars, that you might well expect that the things would never be resolved in?
Yes, I think so. Of course, I mean, as a technique, it was probably influenced by the solar work, where you can tell whether it's a sunspot or the whole corona by measuring its diameter. So that I think there was a clear feeling that you could get into the nature of the source by measuring its diameter.
But for instance, did anyone ever say, well, the stars are a few thousandths of an arc second in diameter?
Oh, I think that we thought that that it couldn't be the surface of stars that we were looking at. We knew that it would have to be something extended.
I see.
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, I think we thought enough about the nature of the sources to say it can't just be the surface of a star radiating on a black body curve. I mean, we knew that very well.
Right, but it still might be much smaller than an arc second, even though it's
yes, of course, that at that time that was a fairly unlikely thing, because it was very difficult to conceive of a thing which had a brightness temperature as high as those such things would have.
Yeah.
I think you'll find that sort of concept in Ryle's Procfissoc paper of about 51 or so.
Yeah, you knew it was not thermal, but still that was a bit too non-thermal.
I know, and it's clearly not thermal, but you see, the solar radiation turned out to be thermal, quite largely. The corona was at a million degrees,
mm-hmm.
and we knew that even if a thing is not thermal in the sense of being a black body, still, it probably had to have particle energies which corresponded to the brightness temperatures we were seeing. And that, in fact, has remained true through most of radio astronomy. It's only when you get to the pulsars that you really have got coherent radiation, and the particle energies do not need to be that high.
Yeah.
So it was very unlikely that you get particle energies that high. And then, of course, there were...
Well, the masers came before the pulsars, to be fair.
That's true. The masers came first. That's quite true. But even if you had particle energies that high, you've got to start worrying about a mechanism that doesn't get optically thick, and we already knew of that concept, you see. So that I don't think we seriously thought that these were stars whose hot surfaces were producing the radio waves.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I talked with Bernie Mills just a couple of days ago about the set of three papers that appeared together in Nature and how they came about at the IRSI meeting. I'd be interested in your version of that IRSI meeting, in particular in Sydney.
Yes.
And so forth.
Yes.
52, that was.
Yes. That was the first big scientific meeting I'd ever been to, and I was, I think, in a fairly bewildered state. I think it's true that up to that time I hadn't had a full appreciation of how much was going on in Australia. And it's certainly true that we had been working independently, so a whole lot of observations came together. And